Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and we're going to be beginning all things political, which you always hear Mondays at 1 here on the Ideas Network. And our guest this hour is White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Margaret Tolliver is the White House correspondent, and she covers U.S. politics and foreign policy. She has covered Barack Obama since 2009 when he began his presidential campaign. She covered Congress, California, Florida politics, and has reported for the Los Angeles Times, McClatchy Newspapers, the Sacramento Bee, and the Tampa Tribune. And she is on the boards of the White House Correspondents Association and the Washington Press Club Foundation. We have a lot to talk about. This is the week that will mark the 100th day of President Trump being in office. So we'll ask you the question, how do you think he's doing? This should be a big week. The president promised on Friday he's going to unveil a massive tax cut for Americans. Big announcement on Wednesday, he said he did not leave details. And evidently the Treasury officials didn't know this was happening. As he arrived at the Treasury offices to sign directives to roll back Obama-era tax rules and financial regulations, Steven Mnuchin he's the Treasury Secretary, asked how far away a tax overhaul proposal was, and he said he couldn't give an answer because tax reform is way too complicated. So what does the president have up his sleeves? We will talk about that. We'll also talk about the president's hopes to revive the Republican health care plan, and we'll look at a potential government shutdown. This could be happening on Friday of this week, and a lot of people are asking the question, will the president sign a spending bill without the border wall? Funding. He has said that he wants that, and he wants it very, very soon. And the question will be whether he will sign a bill to get a budget or if the government will shut down. We had the French elections. We'll talk about those. We had a massive science march, actually marches all over the world. We will talk about that, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. And join us anywhere along the line. Margaret, hello. Thanks for being with us again.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be back.
Yeah, great to have you here, Margaret. Well, let's talk about this tax plan that the president announced last week. Big announcement, he said, coming up on Wednesday. Nobody seems to know very much about this. Do you?
Right, including the budget director and the Treasury Secretary.
Yeah.
At this point, it sounds, everybody's expectation is that we will get an expression of some sort of the outlines of a plan on Wednesday, with more to come, more to follow. Right now, underway at the White House is Sean Spicer's daily press briefing. And just a few minutes ago, the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, was up at that podium getting lobbed some questions about this. Didn't say very much. Said that this plan is going to pay for itself with economic growth. Says that the president's very determined that we can get to sustained growth of at least 3%, and talk just in general terms about both the personal tax side and the business side. He said that he was asked what's more important for the plan, to simplify the process or address middle class taxes. And he said that on the personal side, they're talking about a middle income tax cut and simplification. On the business side, he said, we're talking about making them competitive. So these are the general outlines as they've been described to us so far. But of course, the devil is in the details, and it's unclear whether we will get all of those details on Wednesday or more of a blueprint that puts him on the map during this 100-day week, which inarguably messaging and trying to put right. some accomplishments on the board has been incredibly important mm-hmm. for the president and his team this week.
We're hearing a lot more about the wall, and everybody's asking the question now, will the president sign the bill to keep the government open if it does not include money for the wall?
Everybody wants to know, right?
Yeah.
And this also has been posed already in the sort of opening moments of Sean Spicer's briefing today, because, of course, this is now four days away from sort of the test, right? So he did not answer the question directly. He was asked about it more than once in multiple ways, and he just sort of won't get to the bottom of it. But this is now, the sides are siding off in a standoff about this. That is becoming kind of one of the delineating factors now in whether a government shutdown can be averted. There is, of course, this other option, which is to do a stopgap measure, something that punts this into a week or two from now. At this point, if they continue to insist on wall funding and the Democrats and continue to insist that they are not going to get, pressured into wall spending, the CR may be their only option to avoid kind of the optics of a government shutdown in the president's on the president's 100th day in office, when he and his party control not just the White House but both chambers of Congress. It's certainly something that both chambers of Congress would like to avoid. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably something that the White House also wants to avoid. So this is right now a high-stakes game of chicken now in Washington.
Mm-hmm. He also said that he wanted to revive the Republican health care plan before the 100th day. Does that mean a repeal of Obamacare without a replacement, or does it mean both?
Well, what they had hoped it might mean is a vote, right? This week, but it is now looking increasingly unlikely. It has been for several days, looking unlikely that they can get this across the finish line. What had been talked about is something that might kick some of the decision making over to the states. Now the messaging from the White House is that there will be a vote on a new health care vote when House Speaker Paul Ryan says it's time and when they're ready. This is sort of the best acknowledgement that the White House has got that they may not be able to force a vote this week, but to put it on Congress. Their messaging is to show that they're trying, that if there's a delay, it is Congress that's delaying, not the president, because the president's all about action. But everybody, including the White House, will tell you when pressed about this, including from the chief of staff, Reince Priebus, to the press secretary, that this is really important and it's fair for lawmakers to not want to rush it and to get it right. Of course, everybody knows that with the Republicans in charge in both chambers, anything that ultimately is passed will reflect on their legacy ahead of midterms.
Mm-hmm. Who's writing the bill, Margaret?
Pardon me?
Who's writing the health care bill?
Oh, who's writing the health care bill? You've had in recent days this effort to collaborate both among the Tuesday caucus, which are the moderates, and the Freedom Caucus, the more conservative folks. And then you've got the White House team. This is, seems to be sort of a multi-pronged effort involving lawmakers and the White House, but ultimately it's those lawmakers, it's the Republican lawmakers in these two separate camps that have to be able to agree on the details, and that is where the fine-tuned negotiations really come in. The president has effectively shown his card that he's willing to negotiate. He wants a deal. It is these two camps that are the deciders on whether a deal is possible.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the first 100 days. The president seems to be looking at this and thinking it's a pretty big deal. There was a Washington Post opinion piece this morning where the author is a Trump supporter and saying, don't worry about this, Mr. President. There's no rush. Ignore the critics. You're doing just fine. He mentioned the appointment of Neil Gorsuch, which is a pretty big deal, to the Supreme Court. He talked about enforcing Obama's red line against Syria's use of chemical weapons. He talked about the mother of all bombs on Afghanistan and a few other things. When you assess the first 100 days, first of all, do you think that we should assess the first 100 days? Have many other presidents done incredible things in 100 days? Would you agree with this columnist's observation that there's no rush, that the president needs to ignore the critics and just carry on at a little slower pace?
Well, the answer is both. I know that's not sexy, but it's true. So this has become a measuring stick, a yardstick for presidents from both parties, and it has been for some while now. It's part of tradition, and during the campaign, President Trump unveiled a very ambitious 100-day plan and set it as a benchmark himself. Once the reality of governing took hold, and particularly in the days leading up to the 100-day mark, he said, well, this is completely overrated and silly, and the news media, the media is going to I'm damned if I do, I'm damned if I don't. But within like literally hours of saying that, they began to roll out a very ambitious first 100 days week
right.
this week.
Very ambitious.
Yeah, with a series of interviews, major, news outlets and Sunday shows and TV anchors and all this sort of stuff. And look, he kicked off this morning with a teleconference with astronauts in space. I mean, you know, so the idea that he does not want to define his first 100 days as a success, the idea that he doesn't care about the first 100 days is absurd on the face of it. They have taken a great deal of pains to try to ratchet up the number of executive orders coming out this week. He's got the UN Security Council ambassadors over to visit him at the White House. He's, like I said, he's talking to astronauts. I mean,
right.
You know, he's doing foreign leader calls. He's talking to Japanese and Chinese leaders. He's doing a tremendous amount of programming, all meant to show that he's going to be action-packed. He's got a rally on the day of the first 100 days and so forth. But what are his real accomplishments? What has he accomplished? I think universally there's recognition that the choice of Neil Gorsuch for the Supreme Court and how he withstood those confirmation hearings, his ability to be confirmed, that is will be certainly a lasting legacy of Donald Trump's presidency, no matter what. And so far, you know, there's plenty of Democrats who don't like Judge Gorsuch's judicial record or, what they perceive to be his ideology. But on the face of it, a very little disagreement that he's a qualified nominee who stood up well to those confirmation hearings. So there's that, and nobody can take that away from him. And there is the assemblage of a national security team after a false start with Michael Flynn, who has been able to begin to get matters back on track in terms of some bipartisan respect and in terms of substantive discussions with, you know, foreign leaders about important matters. These are important legacy issues. And on executive orders, you can argue with the fact that the immigration limitations have been, challenged in court, refugee, all that sort of stuff. Absolutely, there's been some fits and starts, but the president is working to execute through executive power his vision when it comes to some policies that appeal to a nationalist part of his base, whether they deal with immigration, hiring, Buy American, all the sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, where have they fallen short? We have a record of that as far as the eye can see as well, whether it's on health care, that repeal in the first 100 days, whether it's on a major bipartisan legislative accomplishment so far, just not a lot to show. And a lot of problems, lingering problems related to the Russia probe that they're under with the FBI, and related to his approval numbers, his ability to reach across the aisle to set aside sort of the some of the petty language of the campaign and move beyond, and that's held him back a bit. So, but your broader question, which is it all over in the first 100 days? No, of course not. I mean, took President Obama, took him a full year and then some to get this his health care vote on Obamacare. Just because you start out strong in the first 100 days is no guarantee at all about ultimately what sort of presidency you'll have. But there is kind of a limited window for power for most presidents. And some of it has to do with who controls Congress and what happens in midterm. Some of it just has to do with the public getting sick of you. You know, it happens to even the most popular presidents. You start out with a tremendous amount of power and the bully pulpit and goodwill from the public and momentum, wind behind your back. And, nobody makes that last for 8 years. Most people don't make it last for 4 years. President Trump knows that with history as a guide, he has a limited amount of time to get stuff done, and usually the beginning is the easiest time. So that is why the 100-day benchmark has been read as something that portends whether you can actually get stuff done and translate what you campaigned on into governance.
Margaret, the Russia probe has been put on hold because of the recess. That picks up again, I understand, next week with the House Intelligence Committee, the Senate as well. Who do we expect to hear from?
Well, and that's the congressional probe. But don't forget separate from the congressional probe is just the ongoing FBI investigation. Right. And from a criminal investigative perspective, that's really probably more important. But, yeah, there is a tremendous amount going on that front. And we're looking in terms of the congressional side once they come back. And we got an inkling of this last week when those letters were sent out calling for testimony. They're looking at appeals not just to Director Comey to come back, but to the National Security Agency's director, that's Admiral Mike Rogers. That's different than the National Security Advisor. We know that's H.R. McMaster. He helps the president set foreign policy. But this is the head of the NSA. They've both been invited to appear at a closed hearing on May the 2nd, and also outreach to John Brennan, the former CIA director, to James Clapper, the former ODNI, that's the director of National Intelligence, and drum roll, please, Sally Yates. You remember Sally Yates?
I remember Sally Yates. Sure do.
Yes, the former deputy attorney general and then acting attorney general who had a sort of standoff with President Trump that led to her ouster. So, yes, there will be a lot of resumed focus. And just sort of as a sidebar for fans of politics and also for those really interested in the substance of this investigation, we know that Devin Nunes, the Republican chair of the House committee from California, had to recuse himself from the Russia part of the probe just to make sort of that controversy go away. So, you know, we'll be watching how does he in fact step back completely? How does that look? And how does he continue to lead other aspects of the Intel committee while he is recused from this? And then what does the interplay between Republicans and Democrats on that committee look like once they resume now that the Nunes controversy is sort of hopefully ebbed?
Mm. Were you surprised? I'm sure you read the very lengthy article in the New York Times yesterday about the FBI email probe of Clinton and also the probe of Russia. Were you surprised, because you covered the Obama White House, that the Obama White House was not in favor of Comey doing a public letter to the Times or to the Washington Post to explain that he was conducting an investigation of the Trump campaign in Russia?
It's really, that article is a fascinating.
Yes, it was.
I highly recommend it for any of your listeners who haven't had a chance to read it yet. But look, these, even not in an election year, these issues are always rife because a president wants to have no doubts about the independence of an investigation from the White House. And you throw in an election year, and it only ratchets that up more. And you throw in the fact that everyone from President Obama and his top aides to Comey thought it more likely than not that it would be Hillary Clinton right now at the helm of the White House. And their considerations, their calculus was really different. It was, if she is going to be the president, we want the investigative work that we did, not we, but the FBI did, to be, you know, beyond reproach. And to have no doubt we weren't putting our thumbs on the scale. And it certainly appears now in the rearview mirror that in trying so hard to carve out that kind of space, they ended up putting his thumb on the scale a little bit in the other direction. I think you could tell that this was something that the White House was really struggling with, which, you know, certainly reporters were trying to ask any sources inside the Obama administration, including at the White House, for any information at all about what was going on in terms of any probes of either of the two major party nominees, and everyone's lips were sealed. But to get these sort of insights, it really does reveal these guys were both tied in knots about how to react and wanting to err on the side of being beyond reproach politically.
Mm-hmm. Margaret Tolove is our guest for All Things Political this week. White House correspondent for Bloomberg News, covers U.S. politics and foreign policy. We'll ask her about the French election as we carry on here. She covered the Barack Obama administration and covered him since when he began his presidential campaign. She's covered Congress, California, Florida politics, and is our guest for All Things Political today. Here's our phone number. There's a lot going on this week with the president saying that he's going to announce this big, big tax plan on Wednesday of this week. The government is supposed to shut down until there is a spending bill signed, but will the president insist that money for the border wall be included or he won't sign the bill? What about repealing health care? And what about assessing the presidency so far, as we're just 5 days away from the president's 100th day in office? We would love to hear from you. So here's how you reach us. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you this very moment. Our email, talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network. There were marches for science all over the world on Saturday, Earth Day. I want to ask Margaret about the significance of continuing marches. Here was the co-founder and one of the main speakers at the Washington, D.C. march, Bill Nye, the Science Guy.
Yet today we have a great many lawmakers, not just here, but around the world, deliberately ignoring and actively suppressing science. Their inclination is misguided and in no one's best interest. Our lives are in every way improved by having clean water, reliable electricity, and access to electronic global information. Each is a product of scientific discoveries, diligent research, and thoughtful engineering. These vital services are connected to policy issues, which can only be addressed competently by understanding the natural laws in play.
Part of the March for Science in Washington, D.C. You have to admit, Margaret, it is a rather unusual thing to have demonstrations all over the world in support of science.
Right, and with some of the great science, nerd science signs.
Yes, yes.
Right. But it is. It was one thing when you saw the Women's March come right after President Trump's inauguration, and that was, you know, a little bit more predictable or sort of in keeping what we've seen with past protests, not to diminish the sort of scope of that. But this now is something different when you see literally thousands of scientists coming to the mall. Look, in basic terms, the Trump presidency for critics has been an absolutely galvanizing event, and you're seeing this across all sorts of cross-sections of groups, and now with the climate change and concerns about protecting the EPA and that sort of stuff, you see this play out with the Science March. The question for political minds is how is that translated, or is it translatable at the ballot box, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're seeing Democrats, since there's still two major parties in the world, this is now effectively a contest between Republicans and Democrats. I suppose if there were Republicans who began to come out of the woodwork and say they wanted to challenge the president for a second term, maybe some of these marches would be geared as internal party fights. But right now, a march against President Trump's policies is, for political purposes, is a march potentially for Democrats. The question for Democrats is, how do you convert that into actual supporters, money, or turnout? And what you've seen in terms of the loss of all of these Democratic seats at the legislative level, at the governor's level, the blame game now, the sort of Bernie Sanders, Keith Ellison camp inside the Democratic Party saying, well, this is partly Obama's fault, is you see on the outside this real show of alliance of support of Democrats saying, isn't this great? We all have like this cause to rally against. On the inside, what there is a real question mark about whether that is convertible into anything that would allow Democrats to take back the Senate, take back the House, take back the White House, and take back some of the state-level races, which become the bench for future elections, right, and for strength.
We're going to go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. What do you make of President Trump's almost first 100 days in office? What are his accomplishments? What are your concerns? And what do you think about what's to happen this week? The president, nobody knows for sure what his tax plan is. I mean, nobody knows. He said he has a big plan, probably will be announced on Wednesday of this week. The government might shut down on Friday. We also don't know whether or not he will insist that there be money for a wall with Mexico. We'll talk more about that wall as we continue, and also about what is the president's policy when it comes to deportation. What about deportation of Dreamers? Has he said things different than what Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, has said? We'll talk about that. But let's go to you and to John in Madison first. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I'm very disappointed. I didn't vote for him, but I said, well, I have to give him a chance. But I'm very disappointed. He has not done really anything. He thinks his presidency is like he's the CEO and he can fire anybody when he wants to, but he's had a lot. I don't think he's going to learn this position. And I just feel like we're going in the wrong direction. He can't get anything done properly. And he has all these cronies that he brought into office with him. And I'm very disappointed. So that's all I got. I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. What was the poll, the Wall Street Journal NBC poll that came out just today or yesterday that shows that his highest approval ratings are among white Southerners, white males without a college degree, and rural voters. And we're looking at approval 57, 58, 59%. Is that the best group for him, would you say, Margaret?
Well, it's certainly a part of his base, and the part of his base that also may be politically useful in terms of leverage is in Midwestern states and is in states with Senate races next year. But the number to look at when you look at the polling, the overall number is important. It gives you a sense of how Americans overall are feeling. But the numbers perhaps more valuable to look at are those splits inside the Republican Party. And as long as a majority of Republicans remain supportive of him, and as long as those numbers hold, then his problems are of a different box than they would be if you really see those numbers inside the party softening. And so, does it impede the president's ability to reach across the aisle and get bipartisan deals if his numbers are in the high 30s? Of course, absolutely. But as long as Republicans control both chambers of Congress,
right,
that may not matter that much,
mm-hmm,
right? The real concern for him right now, when he's still in this sort of pre-midterm phase, at least, and certainly before any kind of reelect heats up, the real concern is the split supportive or not supportive, approval or disapproval inside the Republican Party. And that's the number to look at. And if that number really begins to weaken significantly, you may see a whole different set of rhetoric and approaches to deal making.
Mm-hmm. John, thanks for your call. We go to Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Kurt.
Good afternoon. As much as I love to hear Trump being dissected for all kinds of good reasons, I'm wondering if we are not getting a little too obsessive about what's good or bad for him, whether he's winning or losing according to his own standards on any given day. And we ought to, for intelligent talk radio especially, like National Public Radio, Wisconsin Public Radio, do a little more in-depth look at what is good or bad for the country as a whole, in terms of the presidency, the Congress, and especially what it does or does not do for the not rich and the not powerful.
All right, let's focus on that. Yeah,
I absolutely agree. But Kurt, if you're still with us, I'm interested in what you think are kind of the main markers. What are you looking at or most interested in terms of policy or its impact on the middle class?
Oh, okay, for one thing, we, as Democrats, should not be on the defensive about open trade, free trade, or so forth. You know, there is a lot to say about the trade agreements going back for 20, 30 years that were really, that really messed up people's lives. Now, why can't we have a really intelligent, analytical discussion about what to do with that rather than only talking about, the white, rural, non-educated guys who have lost their jobs and they're going to stick with Trump? What's it going to take to make life, more desirable for those people?
Mm-hmm. Where's the infrastructure bill, Margaret?
Well, I don't think that there was ever an expectation that that would be, well, there may have once upon a time, but not since the White House began, that would be right out of the gate. I think the White House's goal had been to do the health care first and a tax bill and then infrastructure. And, we're still waiting for one, and number two is about to come out. But the infrastructure plan really has always relied in concept on the ability to do some bipartisan negotiations. And that, I think, is the real challenge with an infrastructure legislation. I think when it comes to trade, and Kurt's really good questions and points mm-hmm. about concerns in the past about NAFTA, et cetera, is that I think part of what everyone's waiting on in order to really have that debate is for the president's move. During the campaign, he was going to tear up NAFTA. Then when he was speaking in the context of Mexico, it was like he's going to be very tough about NAFTA. But when he was speaking in the context of Canada, he was talking more about tweaks for NAFTA. But then things changed when he was in Wisconsin for that completely separate visit to Snap-on Tools. But this budding issue over milk imports to Canada from Wisconsin dairy farmers took hold. And all of a sudden, the president was going to be very tough with Canada on NAFTA again. And now there are these 220-day studies underway about, Buy American and High American, and how those policies might come into play vis-a-vis trade agreements. So there's now a lengthy study underway. And so, again, because it is a Republican-controlled Congress as well as a Republican-controlled White House, the president has a tremendous amount of leeway in pursuing changes that he wants to NAFTA. It's his play. It's his next mm-hmm. play. And there are many Democrats, particularly those tied to organized labor, who have been similarly critical about various trade deals over the years and who helped President Trump in some of those key swing states in terms of either soft support for Clinton that didn't translate at the polls or in terms of active embrace of the Trump candidacy precisely because of this sort of protectionist versus globalist attitude and concerns that in the race to embrace globalism, mm-hmm. U.S. policies had hurt a lot of workers. So the president has made this kind of this is a megaphone issue for him during the campaign. It is his card to play.
Thanks, Kurt, for the call. I was interested in your response, and I don't want to go through all of it, but the interview that the president did with the Associated Press, which has been receiving a lot of attention, he seems to be having a really keen eye on making sure that what he considers his great accomplishments are known. He also said some interesting things, and I wonder if you have heard him say this, because you cover the White House, that he doesn't watch CNN anymore. We've heard that he consumes cable news all day long, that he only watches Fox News. Is that true?
It's been a really interesting thing to watch, his kind of what we believe are his shifting TV attitudes. Of course, if you're not there in the room with him, you don't know what he's watching. But
right.
Early on, he was this avid watcher of Morning Joe, and if you would watch, the co-host, they would literally make news. They would say something, and a couple minutes later, you would see the president tweet something that seemed to be picking up on something that they had just said. And there was this kind of goading or testing, this way. Certainly with CNN, ever since the campaign, I have been at campaign rallies and watched some hardcore Trump supporters throw water bottles at CNN reporters. CNN had embodied, fake news and the sort of rhetoric of campaign world. And so the president enjoyed watching it for feedback. And now we're reading both from advisors and from his own comments that his morning watching preference has shifted to Fox. What does that mean? How long is that for? Is that the sign of someone who is in kind of a retreat or a bunker mentality, wanting to feel safer about the audience and the subject matter? Or is that just a matter of preference that will shift again? He is an avid watcher of all television, but particularly cable networks, and all we really know for certain is that right now he is saying that
that he watches
Fox. What his watching patterns
yeah.
are. Yeah.
Charlie in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Charlie.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good. How are you?
Great.
Doing well. Say, about your question of is the president doing his job good, I wanted to just pose it this way, that I think he's doing his job exceptionally well, but I think we need to look at what his job is. And what I mean by that is I'm thinking that the people that have put him in power and that have aligned with him are, I think, are able to use his behavior, whether it's watching TV or just the craziness of how he kind of moves around, moving target, as a shield to be able to move their agenda. We know from the Obama administration that if Congress doesn't like something the president's doing, they can shut that down pretty quick. But it seems like Congress is not really shutting down what Trump is doing. They're more or less using it as a watch the hand while the Trump administration kind of does, you know, like a clown car sideshow in the bigger circus. So what I'm thinking is more along the lines that we should be looking at not necessarily how the Democrats should respond or not necessarily how the Republicans should respond, but perhaps how media should be looking at, you know, what's going on behind the bigger agenda, not what is he watching on TV. I don't care what he's watching on TV. The fact that we have the President of the United States watching TV should scare the crap out of us, right?
Margaret.
I'm interested in what Charlie's thinking of in terms of moving the agenda. What agenda? Are we talking about regulatory, administrative actions that he's able to take? Are you talking about foreign policy, or what are you talking about?
Well, again, I think not necessarily what is it that he's able to take, but what is it that Mnuchin is able to take, or what is it that Pruitt is able to take, or what is it that Ivanka is able to take, or Jared is able to take, in the sense that, you know, there seem to be wheels behind his wheels that seem to be rolling right along. And in some ways, we're able to sort of, some agendas are able to just defer anything that's kind of crazy to the executive office while they're still pushing these policies. I mean, do you think that he's really signing these executive orders after reading them? Or is he just signing them because his quote-unquote trusted advisors say, you know, sign this thing? It's more like saying, well, where's the camera going to be and which way do I need to smile?
All right, Margaret.
Well, I think, executive orders are the tool of every president, and every president has a few levers and a few obstacles to making policy. And, you know, there's what you can do without Congress, and there's what you can do with Congress. The stuff that requires money, you almost always need Congress and things that commit to long-term military engagements, you almost always need Congress. Anything that requires confirmation or a vote, you need Congress. And so, well, it's all presidents use executive orders to some degree, and President Obama certainly tried to expand the use of executive power during his time, and President Trump is doing that now, but it's noteworthy how much of it President Trump is doing now to set policy, perhaps in part because he's had difficulty doing it through legislation. You know, it's hard to say how much any president, I'm not sure how this is different than past presidents, honestly. I mean, looking to regulations and to rules, and when you look at the direction in which President Trump's moving, I think there are very few surprises. He's pursuing a lot of policies, either through executive order or through legislations that he talked about during the campaign. There is transparency from that standpoint, and although as a reporter we always want to see these executive orders before they're issued so that they can be sort of vetted in the media beforehand, ultimately, once they're announced, the language has to be released and the language is available. Folks can see what he's doing.
I want to talk about some things that I'm not sure where they stand right now. There seem to be a lot of actions taken. The bombing of Syria, what's the policy now? The mother of all bombs in Afghanistan, what's the policy now in Afghanistan? And I'm not sure, Margaret, maybe you'll have a better sense of this, of what the policy is concerning deportation and concerning the travel ban. I'm not sure where the Trump administration stands on this. The attorney general made a comment that has been picked up by a lot of press outlets over the course of the weekend. Here is what he had to say about what he considers the president's constitutional power with a travel ban. But where does it stand? Is it going to the Supreme Court? We'll ask Margaret that. In case you didn't hear what Jeff Sessions said, the attorney general, here is what he said.
We are confident that the president will prevail on an appeal, and particularly in the Supreme Court, if not the Ninth Circuit. So this is a huge matter. I really am amazed that a judge sitting on an island in the Pacific can issue an order that stops the president of the United States from what appears to be clearly his statutory and constitutional powers.
He didn't mention Hawaii, so he got a lot of criticism for, an island in the Pacific, Hawaii. But what is the status now? Are we deporting dreamers? Does the president have a different policy than the attorney general on this issue?
Yeah, you know, the dreamer question, if we can separate that for a minute from this broader question about the moratorium on refugees, is really interesting because you have seen some mixed signals, I think, on this front. And it's hard to understand whether the early sort of signs of deportation that we've seen are really part of a plan or more sort of technicalities and slipping through the cracks. I think the president recognized fairly early on that public opinion about the children of undocumented immigrants is different than public opinion, at least writ large, about the folks who make the decision themselves to come to this country without papers. And so the president has always carved for months now a space around that to suggest that he would handle those differently. I think it's still really too soon to understand what his policy is. On this separate question, which got caught up in some of the rhetorical controversy of whether Jeff Sessions wants to recognize Hawaii as one of 50
right.
states or wants to call it an island in the Pacific, I mean, look, this situation continues to kind of move through the lower courts. There is most recently the appellate court decision out of San Francisco declining to have the panel to weigh in on the latest from Hawaii. And so, but look, by all accounts, there is another hearing set for sometime in mid-May in Seattle. That's also out of the Ninth Circuit, and a broad expectation on both sides that some or all of this could end up before the Supreme Court. There's separately a hearing for early May over the president's executive order that's in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. So this is moving on a couple of different tracks, but all headed in that sort of ultimate direction with the big question mark, is the highest court in the nation ultimately going to have to weigh in and be the arbiter
right.
of this?
We're taking more phone calls in a moment. You are listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network. Margaret Tolliv is our guest, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. We want to get her response to the French election. We'll do that in a moment and take more of your phone calls. We have time for a few, huh? Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We can always read and love to read your messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. So use all of those forms. And we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. Next caller is Nate in Milwaukee. Margaret, hi, Nate.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I feel like Trump is running into a couple different problems. Either he's hitting into, are his plans actually going to turn out to be that popular if they were implemented, if they're actually fulfilling everything he said? I mean, yeah, he said he'd replace Obamacare, but the replacement was supposed to be better and cheaper for a person, and the only thing Brian came up for would cover less people and be more expensive for those who had it. So, and I mean, look at calling global warming hoax. That's not exactly good for the country, nor does it deal terribly well with the real world. So he's got some real issues that he's running into as president, and people in the Congress, and he is himself, actually have to face that, well, he was elected without a popular mandate. People may not actually like some of the things that he's talking about doing. Do those things deal with real-world problems? And I kind of wonder if he stopped watching CNN, because they actually did some pretty good reporting on various connections between people that worked for him and all foreign governments.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Nate, for your call. Does he have a thin skin, the president, Margaret?
Well, it certainly... His reaction certainly suggests that it is possible to get under his skin and elicit a reaction from him. It is the way he conducts business. He is really different than President Obama in the sense that President Obama could get prickly also if he felt that you were disrespectful toward him or superficial in your analysis of something he was doing. But he would show it a different way. And President Trump's kind of MO in the campaign in the early months of his tenure as president has been to react publicly when he's bothered or upset by something, through Twitter a lot or through an aside during public remarks. So, you know, one thing that's been interesting to try to analyze as a reporter covering him, who didn't cover him during the campaign. So I watched the campaign, but I was assigned to cover the Clinton campaign, and so I didn't have that sort of the daily time, the one-on-one time that I have now, is trying to assess what is real and what is kind of part of the show. And what I mean is that President Trump's, you know, avowed war on the media is a lot more nuanced in real life and the day-to-day world than it is than you would think just by watching him on TV or going to the rallies. He's very engaged with the media. He's very engaged in terms of daily abilities and availabilities in the Oval Office and the Roosevelt Room, calling the press in to events that were supposed to have been private, calling some reporters up just to talk to them, impromptu interviews. That is not the behavior of somebody who hates and distrusts the media so much that he sees no advantage in having any conversations mm-hmm. with them. So I think if you take that standard, which all of us who cover him kind of witness in everyday life, and apply it to everything else, his dealings with lawmakers, his dealings with the judiciary, his dealings with business people, that there is kind of the public show that makes it, that certainly makes him seem thin-skinned. That's a criticism that you could observe, you know, the public show of anger, a flash of anger, of dismissing something. And then there's the reality of the actual engagement, whether it's with a foreign leader who he might diss one day and then be on the phone to 2 days later. It's understanding what those outward signs, the outward show of annoyance or irritation actually portend in terms of subsequent actions and relationships.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much. Just briefly, just your response. We'll talk about this sometime later. Polls are now predicting that Macron will beat Le Pen in France handily. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would agree that that's what polls show. And I think this has been on two fronts. Number one, sort of a proxy contest between President Obama and President Trump. And number two, a test of whether President Trump's ability to shake up the politics in the U.S. is transferred overseas. It certainly has shaken things up in the sense that you have a runoff between two non-traditional leaders and parties.
Yes.
But in terms of the ultimate outcome, Trump has kept some distance from Le Pen prior to last week because I think they are different candidates on some basic level. Western Europe has been much more resistant to the Trump model than the United States so far.
Jeff in Madison, we have about a minute left, a little more than that. Hello, Jeff.
Hi. There's only 1,288 days, 10 hours, 2 minutes, and 51 seconds till the 2020 election. Who's going to run against him?
Well, I think it may be a little closer to the midterms until we see that. I mean, look, big questions about whether some of the Republicans, particularly in the Senate, who have been willing to speak out against President Trump, are testing the waters for a theoretical, primary challenge, or whether they're just carving out a niche as independents. We will see. Keep an eye on John Kasich in Ohio, just in case, and stay tuned.
And are there certain, in about 30 seconds, are there special elections that you're watching closely to see which way the wind's blowing?
Well, you know, I know people will be watching Georgia. I think the election in Virginia is maybe an important test case looking forward. Anomalies aside, about the relative strength of Democrats' ability to take on Republicans in the midterms to follow.
Margaret, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure. Happy 100 days, everybody.
Thanks, Margaret. You'll be celebrating in D.C., I'm sure, in some fashion. Margaret Tulliv, our guest, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. She covers U.S. politics. She covers foreign policy. She's on the boards of the White House Correspondents Association and the Washington Press Club Foundation. And she has worked for a number of outlets, the L.A. Times, McClatchy, the Sacramento Bee, Tampa Tribune. And we enjoy having her on this show from time to time. Thanks very much to Colleen Duvall for producing this program, and thanks to Chris Molina for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and the second hour of our program, one of our favorite people in Milwaukee, Daniel Golden, who really keeps books alive and brings all kinds of authors to this city, event after event after event. He has books that he thinks you would like to read. We'll talk about them.